Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Day Zero podcast. A little bit of a shift this week for our regular listeners. Instead of our regular topical coverage, this week's binary episode, we're going to do a follow-up video to our previous discussion from a few years back on the future of exploit development. And it's one we've been wanting to make for a while because where it's been a few years, things have changed. Our views have changed a bit because a lot of what we talked about in that video, such as MTE, was at the time mostly speculation, but has now been brought to fruition. Before we get into it, though, I think Z wants to clarify a little bit on the scope of what we mean when we say exploit development and some of the terminology there.
Yeah, and I also want to say with our last video, I did feel like we came across somewhat pessimistic. And I know some people have actually used that as a reason to not get into exploit development. And I am definitely a lot more optimistic than I was at the time of recording this. But yeah, jumping into some of the terminology that I wanted to hit on. One of the changes I've seen over the past couple years actually is a change in what certain things mean. Just as more people are coming into security, certain terms are kind of becoming almost genericized in a bit, like exploit development. When we talk about exploit development and the future of exploit development, what do we mean? Like, you know, it's kind of been genericized where some people are using it to refer to like their development of like a web exploit where they're exploiting a, you know, time-based SQL injection that does take a little bit of complexity there in terms of not ordering the requests, but making them. There's some complexity there. So they're developing an exploit for a bug. Completely fair to apply the term there, but what we mean and how we're talking about specifically in the context of memory corruption bugs and low-level exploitation. In a similar way, binary exploitation is kind of similarly generic or genericized, I guess, where you could mean it as, you know, exploiting of any sort of binary software. So, you know, any application that gets compiled down to binary code, any vulnerability, any exploit of that could be binary exploitation. But again, more what we're getting at are specifically when it comes to memory corruption bugs. So that's like your buffer overflows, out of bounds access, your memory overlays like use after free or double free or type confusions. It's those sorts of bugs and not like your command injection to, you know, inject shell commands into a string or something. Those are kind of higher level, what I'd call just general AppSec. And the thing that makes binary exploitation unique is this focus on memory corruption. And traditionally, exploit development has referred to the development of exploits for memory corruption bugs. I do think that's actually going to kind of change in the near-ish future, and we will see it used a lot more in the generic sense. But for now, for this video, that is kind of what we're focusing on, is memory corruption bugs and vulnerability research, as in finding these low-level bugs.
Yeah, so that's what we're talking about here. So I do want to go into a bit of a quick summary of what we said in our previous video for anyone who might not have seen it or hasn't seen it in a while, because as I said, it is a few years old. In that video, both Z and I agreed on thinking that the memory corruption exploit meta would shift towards more of a higher level application security focus, and that memory corruption would go on a decline due to both more secure development practices as well as things like memory tagging on the mitigation front. Now, in fairness, we didn't say memory corruption would die or anything. We were very clear on that. But we did say that some of the mitigations that were coming and stuff might accelerate the decline. And as Z mentioned, we were fairly pessimistic about the future of memory corruption. And while I don't think our views have 180'd, like haven't completely flipped around, I do think we want to dial back some of our opinions a bit. So on memory tagging specifically, because it was a fairly big focus of that video.
Yeah, I actually have a little quote of you from that one where you actually said, like, memory tagging is the next big scary thing. My fault for coming after that. But, like, and it was at the time, like, we had, like, Intel CET was coming with Control Flow Guard. Well, Control Flow Guard exists, but, like, a hardware force Control Flow Integrity and Shadow Stack. Like, it was coming. MTE was coming, another hardware thing. Like at the time, it's just like there's this hardware security that really can be very impactful depending on how it lands. Like it really was just kind of this looming thing that we hadn't gotten to play with yet or explore with or hack. But now there has been more opportunity and there is more insight into it, more research. So it's not the scary being anymore. Go ahead.
And not only that, it hasn't really been adopted nearly as much as we thought it might be. And part of that is due to some of the restrictions that it has. So talking a little bit about memory tagging, I don't want to go too deep into it, but the granularity was fairly highly granular. I think it's granular down to 16 bytes. And it also had a fairly small tag space of only 16 potential tags because it uses the upper byte or top byte ignore feature of ARM. So because of that, you know, it's fairly limited in how effective it can be. It also can't really prevent intra-object overflows, which is something we have seen a few times. The other thing that is relevant with it is that MTE actually has two modes, that it has the synchronous and the asynchronous mode. And in the asynchronous mode, which where it has been adopted seems to be the mode that's in use because the sync mode is somewhat expensive. But in async mode, it can also be raced. And memory tagging in general seems to be fairly expensive in terms of things like battery power, which when you're talking about low power devices like phones and things like that, is a pretty big consideration because vendors don't really want to impact battery power for regular users for a mitigation that they don't even understand what it does. So because of that, MTE has had kind of limited adoption. And on top of that, it is also weaker than what we thought it might be, where we have more of the implementation specifics of how it works. So, because of
how it works in some situations. Obviously, everybody can kind of do their own thing here. Allocators can do different things. But there has been more of the opportunity to kind of explore its limits and what it is actually doing. And as you can probably guess, you know, hackers are going to hack on it. And thus, you know, finding, you know, ways around it, ways that you can still wiggle in your exploit, things you can do to avoid and all of that. As with so much, it's just the more exposure you get to it, the easier it is to start finding flaws, to start finding ways around it and, you know, ways to keep your exploits alive.
Yeah. And some of those ways were being explored and talked about pretty early on when MTE started to land. So, yeah. MTE, to rephrase my previous quote that Z brought up, it's not as big and scary as, you know, it seemed like it might be at the time. And it's limited adoption. It's been a little bit surprising to me, honestly. I thought it would be adopted a little bit more than it is, but, you know, I guess it's just more expensive than people were hoping it might be at the before it was introduced as well. And it's kind of fallen into the same category as pointer authentication has, because Apple's been leveraging pointer authentication, which also leverages a top byte ignore functionality of ARM. They've had pointer authentication for a long time now, and it hasn't really come to other devices. I know there was some like discussion of maybe it coming to Android at one point. There was some developer discussion on that, but it seems like that's just not happening. It doesn't seem like anyone else is really interested in it. So it seems like these hardware tagging mitigations are just not really being picked up. You know, maybe that will change down the line. Like maybe it's just a longer time scale that's required for that change to really take effect. But in the near future, it doesn't really seem like these hardware mitigations are going to be adopted across a wide area of the space. It's really only on the cutting edge that it's even looking like it's possible to be adopted in the near future. So that's something that we wanted to touch on because, as I said, like it's something we know more about now than we did then. And there's been some progress on things like CET, though, and we've gotten a little bit more information on that, which you had kind of alluded to, Z.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the same case on both. Like, adoption hasn't really come at the... I mean, I'm not that surprised, actually, when it comes to CET and adoption. Like, computer hardware kind of has that standard life cycle. Something gets introduced, but, you know, people aren't necessarily going to update as soon as possible. And then, so a lot of software does support CET, just like we'll get that compiled in there with like, specifically, actually, I should say, the side of CET that's doing control flow enforcement on like indirect branching, not so much on the side of ShadowStack. ShadowStack has felt like it support just in software being compiled with those instructions, not really as well supported. It is out there, but the indirect stuff is, you know, software supports it, but hardware still isn't necessarily supporting it too well. It is worth mentioning, CET is an Intel thing specifically. There is kind of a Zen 3 or AMD response to it, where they have also implemented CET in ShadowStack, but I don't believe their instructions are compatible with the Intel instructions. So it's seen even kind of less adoption out there, but still, like, the adoption, you know, technology takes time to change. And now that we've had more time to actually explore these, there are still kind of problems with them. Exploitation is, you know, still going to be around. I do think ShadowStack gets adopted. That's going to do a lot, especially hardware enforcement there, to cut down on ROP specifically. And that's really what it's set up to stop, is like anything that's going to... So ShadowStack actually originates, I think, before ROP was a thing, more as a like way of detecting just the kind of a stack canaries became more popular. But I think ShadowStack comes from about the same time period, where you would just overflow the stack, overwrite the saved return address, and it would be able to detect that corruption. So kind of goes back, and it's never really been adopted in all that time.
I do want to go into a bit of the nuances, because part of why I thought memory tagging would be adopted more than it has been is because MTE is kind of built into the execution cycle, right? So when a pointer is being followed, like anytime there's a memory dereference, the CPU internally is going to be doing that tag checking and that tag. There is some special instructions that are needed for setting up the tags in the first place, and that's why, like, you need kernel support for MTE, so it's not purely the hardware that's being relied on. But for the most part, a lot of that checking is being done implicitly by the CPU, whereas with things like CET, it does introduce a lot of those custom instructions. So for something like that, I assume a longer timeline on adoption, because you kind of need that support by the compiler, and you need developers to be using the latest compiler and using the right flags and all that kind of thing. Whereas with memory tagging, it was more centralized in the hardware. So that's why I was thinking MTE might get a bit more adoption than something like CET would, but it just hasn't really worked out that way.
Well, CET being Intel actually felt to me like it would get a pretty good adoption just because it's Intel. Like, it's there. Everybody, like, people run Intel. It's not,
yeah, it seems exactly like Intel's not even interested in pushing it in their own CPUs.
Yeah. I will say with Intel, with CET, it has landed. There are devices with it, so can kind of explore the limits of these things. And while ShadowStack will do a good deal of damage when it comes to trying to specifically go for like ROP and that really late exploit stage. So when we talk about stages during like exploitation, kind of have the early stage where you get some basic primitive, you turn that into like a more powerful primitive, like arbitrary read write and probably a control flow hijack, or you use the read writes to make some hijack, whatever. And then an often thing would be to create a ROP chain and then just ROP to actually get your arbitrary code execution and enable that. And so having the ShadowStack at the hardware level is going to make it hard to actually go for ROP. So that is going to do a lot of damage to a classic exploitation technique. However, the meta when it comes to exploits in the last couple of years has shifted away, and that's just because like control flow integrity also has kind of done a little bit of damage there. That is kind of seen in software a bit more, but also just in terms of writing like a stable exploit and all of that, something that's more portable. People are kind of moving more towards the data oriented exploitations where, rather than targeting like hijacking control flow, you just find like some actual code that's going to, maybe it's going to execute like a shell command, and you kind of introduce that sort of bug there, like introduce your own commands into that, or, you know, you can chain it whatever way. That the thing about data oriented is it's not a generic technique. You can't just apply some generic data oriented technique and get shell code running or get your own code running like you could with ROP. It does require more of a kind of specific knowledge of the application. But that has kind of been where the meta for exploits has gone, is this other thing, and that's not impacted by the ShadowStack. That's actually also not impacted much by control flow integrity, because the point is you're only messing with the data of the application rather than the control flow. And so,
yeah, and I think part of why that's happened is people have realized that code execution is overrated. It's kind of been what has always been chased for quite a while. But then when targets started to become more hardened and we started getting more hardening on the control flow, people realized like, wait, I don't even need to deal with all of these things. Like, I can just go for the data, and it's a lot easier and it's a lot harder to protect. So yeah, I agree that that shift has been noticeable, and a lot of the mitigations that we've been talking about outside of like MTE, and even that, it's protecting the pointers more than the data itself. Yeah, like a lot of the mitigations like CET and stuff are not really able to do anything about data oriented attacks.
Yeah, and to clarify, you can still end up from a data oriented attack, you can still end up with running arbitrary code. It's just you end up actually getting it run. You don't end up hijacking the process you're in order to run it.
You're not running it as a weird machine.
Yeah, that's the perfect way to put it. It's not weird machine programming in order to get to that point. I mean, I guess you could actually still argue about with the data being weird machine. Either way, you know, I'll just leave it as like, you do still get code like you could still run arbitrary code. It's not like you're limited to only dumping the database like a SQL injection or something. Like, you're not only getting data out effect, you're still able to go for, if you want to. There are actually reasons like kernel exploitation where just modifying the data is actually sufficient to be very useful. But yeah, like data oriented has kind of been the shift in meta already. So now these mitigations, it's like, you know, we're already kind of able to bypass many things that are coming out now, and thus they seem a lot less scary now that we're kind of moving towards a different meta for exploitation anyhow. But at the same time, that's leading into a different meta when it comes to the mitigations that we're seeing too.
So far we've been walking back a lot of the stuff we've talked about with mitigations that we saw coming, we just didn't know a lot about them yet. But there has been some work that's been done that we didn't really see coming that's been pretty effective too. And as per usual on the mitigation front, Apple is leading the charge on this. So on the iOS side of things and whatnot, there's been chaotic type. So for those who aren't really familiar or haven't really seen that, chaotic type is something that Apple has introduced, and it's basically introducing type isolation into the heap. So taking advantage of things like type confusions or overflowing to hit some specific object is a lot more difficult because you're going to have the same objects grouped together. So overflowing into a different object, you might not be able to give yourself the same kind of primitives that you were before. And for doing memory overlapping and things, like, it's going to be a lot harder to overlap arbitrary controlled data with useful pointers. So that's something that's been pretty effective on the Apple side of things. And it's a mitigation that's not necessarily hardware enforced, but it's more at the design level. Another thing that Apple has done is something like Blastdoor. So again, for those not familiar with the Apple mitigations, Blastdoor is more on the attack surface reduction side of things. So it's basically making it so that JIT and things that are really useful for exploitation, like being able to set up arbitrary code, is just not turned on if you're in like a locked down mode. So yeah, there has been some stuff that has been pretty effective and has been forcing meta changes from how memory corruption has been exploited in the past. But again, it's mostly been on Apple and it's not really been adopted across the industry. So I do want to point them out. And
yeah, chaotic
type, it is something that could potentially influence into other products in the future. But yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to mention, like, chaotic type is pretty new. It is newer than, like, our last video, for example, wasn't even out yet.
Yeah.
That does a lot, and it starts acting at a slightly different level, as we were saying, than just the hardware mitigation and a lot of those mitigations, like CT. It's, you've already got the ability to hijack control flow or, you know, do something like that, and then this mitigation's kicking in. Whereas some, like, chaotic type is really kind of starting to actually try and cut off the bug class itself. And MTE does a little bit of this with the probabilistic overflow aspect. And like, there are aspects of it, but that's almost like the focus of chaotic type is cutting off certain bug classes as being, making it very difficult to exploit them at like the compile time, in a sense, or just that structure. So like, there is that shift now, kind of on the defense side, to trying to cut off the bugs and not just the exploit, not mitigating the exploit, but mitigating the bug itself, which has also, of course, led towards safer languages. You know, of course, Rust being the big one, but there has been this kind of change also in the meta of how things are being defended. And you talked about, or you just mentioned, like Blast Door and attack service mitigation. That's also been a big thing on like the Android side of trying to limit what areas are actually privileged or not, or what's being done in privileged areas, and limiting the surface that you can attack privileged code from. That has also been a big thing on Google's side. I'm not sure if I'd say the same about Windows, though, and a focus on that aspect. But I am not a Windows researcher, so while I'm not sure if I can say that, it's because I'm genuinely not sure, and not because I think, like, oh, they're not doing anything about security. Because Windows, you know, absolutely, like, I know they invest a lot onto finding the bugs early. I wouldn't be surprised if they were, well, I mean, we know they do a lot of fuzzing, so I'm not surprised to know that, if they also kind of took more of the, like, sanitizer route, rather than tossing these mitigations onto users to detect it kind of in real time as they're running, just implementing it, even stronger things earlier on in their own, like, fuzzing setup and all of that, just happening earlier on in the whole development process, or happening as part of development, not making its way there. And that would be why it's just not as seen. Not that Windows is just stupidly insecure or something, because they take security seriously also.
Yeah, I quickly want to mention it. It's not just that we're like hating on Windows and that's why we're not bringing it up, but Windows is in kind of a weird position, like a unique position, because of how they support legacy code and have that design goal. Making radical changes, like introducing like big mitigations or even like using secure languages, is just very difficult in that area, and it's not something I'm expecting to see anytime soon. Whereas on the mobile side, and like with Linux and stuff like that, like, it's easier to enforce change there. So that's why we're talking about them more in this discussion.
I think there might actually be, since you're talking about the secure languages, there might actually be some Rust in the Windows kernel now. I know there's support for Rust drivers now, where I'm quite certain there is. And I think I recall reading about getting Rust in, about Microsoft at least starting to do some rewrites of components into Rust for the Windows kernel. I'm just pulling up an article about that. This is just an article I just Googled for, so I'm not going to stand behind like the quality of the content here. But it does seem like somebody during Blue Hat IL of last year, which, shout out to Blue Hat IL, is an awesome conference. But they talked about doing some engineering at Microsoft for, this is a quote here, I guess, you will actually see Windows booting with Rust in the kernel in the next several weeks or months. So, you know, they are kind of more silent about it, but adopting Rust or more secure languages, you know, even into Windows.
Yeah, but with Windows, you have a lot more vendors in the ecosystem. Yeah. So it's going to be a lot harder to get that secure language adoption across like the stack, you know?
Yeah, it might be there in the kernel, but not every driver. And that has been a constant problem, even with like Windows implementing SMAP or SMAP, has been like drivers still exist. And, you know,
yeah, they, and it's things, that legacy inheritance again that's causing a lot of those issues. Whereas Linux is just like, okay, well, you know, you're going to deal with this. The driver authors are going to have to rewrite these things. Whereas Windows doesn't want to do that, because then people complain when their things don't work. And yeah, so yeah, I did want to quickly bring that up. But this does segue nicely into another important aspect on memory corruption, and that is the movement to secure languages. So obviously, like, the rewrite it in Rust is a bit of a meme, and rewriting something as big as a kernel, like let's say the Linux kernel in Rust, is realistically not going to happen. But what
quickly
is, well, I mean, I just don't think it's going to happen in general, but what does seem to be the focus is, okay, we can't rewrite everything in memory safe languages, but what about things that are in the lower privilege levels? So things that are exposed to like sandboxes and things. Well, when we narrow down the scope to that, okay, we can rewrite drivers that are exposed to those areas in more secure languages. And that's something that seems to be somewhat taking off. So we've we've talked a little bit on the podcast before about how Rust is being adopted into the kernel, specifically for Android. It's the binder driver, which is the IPC driver, and has been a source of memory corruption issues for years. That's been receiving a rewrite in Rust. Now, as far as I know, there's still no Rust code that's been shipped to a production kernel. Like, it hasn't been upstreamed. But there is a more of a shift to using the memory safe languages in the sandboxed areas, which, you know, again, kind of kills the, or tries to kill the memory corruption issues earlier on without having to rely on the mitigations. Again, though, like I said, like, these rewrites have been in progress for a long time now, and they still haven't shipped. It's something where it's, because Rust is such a radical change from C, where it's a lot harder to write, you have a lot more of these compile time guarantees that you have to meet. It's tricky to rewrite things in Rust and make sure that they work. So it's not something that's going to be immediate. It is going to be something that's a bit time lagged, but it is something to consider that, you know, defenders are trying to mitigate memory safety issues, at least on the lower privilege levels, which means that while memory corruption, again, like, I'm not saying it's going to die or even that it's going to be impacted super severely, but it might require chaining with other higher level issues in order to reach the memory safety issues. You might have to do more of the, you know, lateral movement in order to reach those areas compared to before, where it's just like immediately jump into hitting memory corruption issues in the browser or something.
Yeah, so one thing says any sort of rewrite, as you're saying, it takes time. So a really common question is, you know, what about these memory safe languages? If we keep adopting them, if everywhere adopts them, are memory corruption vulnerabilities going to be extinct? And the simple answer to that is yes. Technically speaking, no. There will always still kind of be the potential for bugs or for those types of bugs somewhere. Like, there's going to be some legacy system or whatever. But like, if everybody were to actually adopt a type safe or memory safe language, then yeah, we're not really going to see a lot of memory corruption bugs because everybody's using it. But that is a huge ask to be like, everybody adopt memory safe languages. Over time, we are going to see more and more of it, and new projects do tend to use better languages. Like, C isn't a popular language for new projects, but there is still a lot of legacy, and there are new projects being written in C. I do still see that from time to time. But even trying to rewrite like something like Linux, even if they were going to go all in on Rust, that's going to take a very long time, because it's not going to be, let's rewrite everything in Rust in one shot. It's going to be, let's rewrite this component. Like, we're talking about binder, Bluetooth driver, I think, is something Google's been working on also. It's like, let's do this component. That's going to take, like, you know, a few years, and maybe another component gets worked on, maybe another and another. And it does add up over time. But actually getting to that point of using it is like a absolutely massive, massive ask. There's still going to be software out there that's just like, no, we know C, let's use C because that's what we know. Or we already have things fundamentally like done in C, whatever. Like, there's this huge legacy push that's going to continue to exist. And there's going to be legacy software, there's embedded software. There's a lot of places where it's just not easy to move. And one other point is, we actually were just talking about CVRS, happened to be within the last few weeks, where you could use entirely safe Rust code and still have memory corruption issues. Now, they are fixing that, so like, shouldn't be around, but that was entirely safe Rust code, and you could introduce these bugs. Not likely to end up in a real product, but it was still safe code that, you know, unlikely, but could have existed, or, you know, could have been planted into software. And the other thing is, especially on Rust, is it's not that everything is safe in Rust. It's just that you have unsafe blocks of code that say, this is where you want to audit if it's not. But auditing it is actually kind of hard. If you've done or tried to do a Rust audit, if you want to go just with the unsafe code, like, you can audit that and just look at all your unsafe blobs and see if they do anything. But there's so much context about everything else going on that you need to keep in mind. That while, yes, it's nice that it is able to specify, look at these areas, and that does help with auditing, it's not easy, and there still can be these bugs that slip through because you just don't notice them. We had one of our Spot the Vuln challenges used to be a Rust vulnerability like that, where it's just like, here's some Rust code, and you take a look at it, there is some unsafe code, but it's not just clear that this is the problem. Of course, it is the problem. Like, we only had like 10 lines of code. There's not much place for there to be a problem, but you know, Rust can still have issues. And we also talk about like memory. Another important aspect is, you know, we'll talk about occasionally, it's been a while, but like PHP memory corruptions, where even in PHP, which is considered a type safe, or a memory safe language, will have a memory corruption bug in it that allows for remote code execution. Granted, you're already running PHP code, so like that RC isn't as useful. It's mostly used when you have like safe mode on and like to bypass the safe mode. But the point is, like, the language runtimes, unless they're also written in a safe language, are then also susceptible to having these memory corruption vulnerabilities. So like, they're going to continue to exist for a long time. Like, I don't think there is any talk whatsoever about rewriting PHP in Rust, for example, or Python. Python has the same. They've had a number of bugs that, you know, have been in the Python runtime, although you have less access to actually abuse those from the outside, so they are a lower risk area. But more the point that, like, they do still exist even when using type-safe languages, unless the type-safe language is secure. Actually, just came to mind, but JavaScript. JavaScript bugs are found all the time and exploited in the browser. JavaScript is a memory-safe language. And if, for some reason, I keep wanting to say type-safe, so if I say that, just understand I mean memory-safe. But yeah, JavaScript bugs are another good example where, like, you're in the browser, you're finding this memory safe language and you're exploiting a memory corruption bug in it. They are going to continue to exist for a very long time. They will continue to get harder and I think more rare as we go. They're still kind of out there. The mitigations aren't really stopping the attacks now that we have more of a take on, like I mentioned before, the data oriented attacks, as we look at other ways of attacking software and have a better understanding of exploitation. These mitigations aren't really stopping us, but they are changing things. And I think that's the same thing with Rust. Like, well, we focus on Rust, but safer languages is just, they will change things, but it's unlikely.
Rust is just a useful vehicle for talking about memory safe. But yeah, we mean memory safe, not just Rust. Yeah,
Rust is like a really good vehicle for it because they do, in my opinion, a lot of things right. And they're actually useful as like the low level replacement for where C is used. But yeah, no, there are other options there too. And I mean, you know, even something like Golang actually has unsafe. Like, you can use unsafe. It works a little bit differently than Rust, or works differently than Rust, period. But like, you know, you can do unsafe pointers in like Golang too, which is, you know, generally considered memory safe, but he still introduced these bugs. So main point there is, like, there's a lot of places for the stuff to hide. They're maybe not the most, you know, sexy areas to find your bug in, but they're still going to exist. They're still going to be, you know, areas for, you know, this sort of memory corruption vulnerability to matter. Yeah, I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, and I mean, we didn't really talk about it on the podcast, but the White House had also released a white paper recently talking about memory safety and trying to push for more of the adoption of memory safe languages. Rust they do give as an example, but you know, like what we're trying to do, like, they're mostly just talking about the memory safety as a whole. But the adoption of that is slower than a lot of people would like, and you know, part of the reason for that is people, like, developers want to be tasked on shipping features that are going to sell things, right? The reality is rewriting things that already work to be more security safe is not a selling point. And so,
and introduce new bugs. You rewrite, yeah, you're going to introduce new bugs most of the time.
That too. But yeah, like, the reality is that rewriting any significant amount of code is just, if it gets done at all, it's going to be done on the long time scale because it's not a high priority for a lot of companies. Google has kind of been unique in trying to push forward the security on like open source products like the Linux kernel, for example. I mean, obviously there's a feedback loop there that benefits them, but you know, Google and Apple have kind of been leading the charge on trying to do this adoption of more memory safe languages and trying to push the mitigations forward, but they're trying to drag everybody else with them, and that's a heavy weight. So outside of like the cutting edge targets, like mobile, for example, like mobile bugs are going to be cutting edge targets, and it's going to be harder and harder. I feel like iOS and Apple has already kind of reached the point where, and QWERTY actually talked about this in a presentation he gave somewhat recently in the last year or two, at Hexacon, actually. iOS has kind of reached the point where unless you have help, it's not really feasible to break into it and start trying to find and exploit memory corruption issues. It's just too, it moves too fast. There's too much hardening, too much sandboxing that's been in play. So like on those kinds of targets, it is maybe a little bit towards the glum side of like what we were in our first video. But the reality is most products don't fall into that category and probably won't for a long time. So that's kind of where we wanted to dial back our previous opinions, I guess, and kind of update on what our thoughts are involving those mitigations and memory safe languages.
Yeah, and actually on that point, like, yes, those top end products, those, you know, those hard targets are going to, you know, be impacted by that. But at the same time, as that happens, the value of being somebody who can do that sort of exploitation increases. I think on our last video, kind of speculated with regards to like how much money is like a government entity really willing to spend on those sorts of exploits, and you know, will human intelligence be more valuable? And I still have no idea on that case on how much value those are actually going to have to them or any of that, but it does seem like there's still room kind of there, like things are still kind of being spent. Because of the challenge of finding issues, like they actually kind of are more valuable now. So I don't think things are even going to be dead there. It will take more research, and like you're not finding a bug all the time, or you need to work with other people and do all of that. But it's not like that has no valuable or has no value because it's rare. Like, yeah, you might not have as many jobs being published for it because there aren't as many people able to do it. But that doesn't mean the people able to do it have like no value, or it's not a lucrative position or job to have. And that's,
I think that would be a good way to state my final position on it, is just that it's becoming harder and harder, and in some cases impossible to be a one-man army like it was 20 years ago or something. It just means you need more resources. It's not going to be killed off though.
Yeah. And even at the lower end of that, I think there's still going to be the demand. Like if you're a pen tester on a random corporate network, there's going to be a lot of this random legacy software that just isn't as secure and is not the high-end product. You're maybe not going to write like a browser, you probably wouldn't today either, a browser exploit on the middle of a red teaming engagement or network pen test. But you might write an exploit against that random driver or something, the random webcam software, or IoT software. So it's still going to be a valuable skill set in there. And in the professional sense, there's, you know, you're maybe not going to be able to do that high-end exploitation, but there's still a ton of targets that are going to take a very long time to, I guess, potentially phase out and like become secure, use secure languages, like such a slow process that it's still going to be a useful skill to have. That said, I do feel like, you know, if I were getting started today, I would want to understand higher level application security also. And that's not just because of the fact that, you know, finding those bugs is kind of important too, but with data-oriented exploits and kind of going that route, it requires you understand the application better, so you kind of understand the sort of bug you can use a memory corruption to introduce via corrupting the data. And to get to that point, you need to understand all these other types of bugs that you might be able to do something with. So you kind of need more knowledge today, and you need that more rounded knowledge beyond just memory corruption. And I was kind of thinking about this when I actually spoke on our last video about how, you know, I think I said something along the lines of I wouldn't bet on a long career in purely binary, because that's kind of what I was thinking about, is the fact that you don't want to only know binary. If you want to be good at binary, you need to understand the rest of application security too, and the other types of bugs, because they do matter both to binary and just to finding bugs in general. You need to have that wider, more rounded knowledge regardless. And that's more what I was saying. Like, you might not only do binary, but it's not like that non-binary knowledge is just entirely useless to the binary world. These things work together, and you're better at the binary, I think, when you understand the rest of it. So I'd still kind of stand by that idea of you're not going to only know binary. You can't just do that anymore.
Yeah, but, I mean, on the hardened targets, like saying, oh, I'm just going to go looking for a Stack Overflow where they read in an integer and there's an int overflow and something, and that lets me corrupt memory. Like, those days are kind of over on hardened targets. But where you have the more comprehensive coverage with vulnerabilities interacting from that higher level and having the memory safety, like those kinds of issues, yeah. It requires more of a comprehensive knowledge of the target. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, that's kind of the big push I'd make. Like, yeah, things are getting harder because you do need more knowledge, I think, but I don't think exploit development is just going to be an entirely dead art too soon here. Yeah, things
it's slowly, just going to be integrated change. More with other stuff.
Yes. Yeah. More integration, needing more knowledge, and that's just kind of the natural progression. You need more knowledge. It just happens that that other knowledge that you need also helps you out if you don't do binary and you just focus on the higher level. But it also makes it easier to transition to binary, because binary has a lot to learn, but you do benefit by understanding the wider security realm.
For sure. It's not something you can just ignore, like you might have been able to in years past. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, like in years past, you could really just focus on learning. Well, I mean, we didn't even know how to exploit some of the issues we exploit these days. Like, you know, use after free was kind of an understood denial of service for a while. Like, you could do some issues, but nobody really had a solid handle on exploiting them. Whereas today, like, it's just like, you have a use after free. That is probably exploitable because we understand it better. But that takes understanding the application in order to do that. So in years past, like the simple Stack Overflow example, like that's all you need to learn. There's just so much more to applications today, and we've kind of formalized that knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, you can kind of see the same thing. Like, even if we just take memory safety issues in a bubble, and specifically heap corruption, a lot of the early days, like when you talked about exploiting the heap, you were talking about attacking the allocators, right? You were talking about getting your house of style primitives, where it's like, okay, this application is using this allocator. I know how I can turn heap corruption into an arbitrary write or something. And then as time went on, heap corruption shifted more towards like, okay, what kind of objects does this application have that I can take advantage of? You're shifting more from the generic techniques to the application specific techniques, which requires that deeper understanding. And that's just kind of progressing more and more in that direction. And the mitigations are kind of forcing you down those paths too.
Yeah. But on a whole, it's still going to live on for a good while. And I think even on the side of like, you're not doing the high end products, it's still going to be useful knowledge to have. And it just makes you a more valuable, you know, pen tester, red teamer, whatever, when you have that ability and that becomes a skill you can draw upon, even if it's not your primary skill or you're not only doing that.
Yeah. And, you know, part of why we wanted to make this video and update our views here is because the way we did our first video did seem a little bit discouraging. And some people did take it that way. They took it as like, okay, well, then it's, you know, it's a waste of time to learn memory safety issues. And that isn't necessarily what we were trying to convey in that first video, but the clarification on things like MTE and how things have changed since then have further pulled us back towards saying, like, you know, the memory corruption knowledge is still useful to have. It's just, it might be harder to put into practice, but it's not like useless or something.
Yeah, like, I don't reject things that I said last time. I'm not like, oh yeah, this is a 180 change.
But yeah, like our views aren't completely flipping. It's just they've been kind of tempered by some of the things that we'd speculated about at the time coming to fruition and being able to take a look at how things have manifested. Yeah.
Tempered and clarified, because I mean, some of it I think is easily taken. Like, I don't fault anybody for taking us as pessimistic with the last one. But I'm hoping we've been able to get across some of the nuance a little bit better here and just, you know, give you some hope towards continuing with exploit development, because I do think it's still a worthwhile area to learn.
And I will say personally, like, beyond just how we conveyed it, like, I'm more hopeful now than I was back then, too. Because, like you said, where you had these things coming that were looming over you, it's easy to just kind of assume it's going to be the ideal case where, you know, with MTE, for example, there was a lot of nuances and restrictions to it, and it hasn't been adopted as much as we might have thought it would be back then. So it was worth making a video on. And like we said, we kind of wanted to do it a little bit earlier, but we just hadn't got around to it, and we finally have now. So, yeah, I think that's pretty much everything, though, unless you have any things you want to add, Z.
No, I think we've...
That's all I had to say.
I think we've hit everything. I will mention, as we're ending the episode here, I think this is kind of a format that we want to adopt a little bit more, not specifically just taking over binary episodes, but doing more discussions, having more guests on. So I'd appreciate hearing any feedback on this sort of thing. Or if you actually have a question or something you want us to address, feel free to hit us up on Discord or wherever else you can reach us.
Yeah, for sure. And it's something nice that we can do, especially on weeks like this, where the binary episodes in particular have been harder to do lately. There's just been kind of a drought of topics. But these kinds of discussions are a bit more timeless. We're not as time constrained on trying to look at things within the last couple weeks or something. So, yeah, it is a format that we're hoping to go with going forward. So any feedback would be appreciated. So, yeah. With that said, thanks everyone who tuned in, and we'll see you in the next episode.